8. Healing Instinct. The cunning ploys and behind-the-scenes meddling of nature's puppeteers would make Machiavelli gasp in awe. But hosts are no pushovers. In addition to having immune systems and healthy gut bacteria to guard against infection, we and other animals come into the world equipped with parasite-tracking radar, an array of sensors attuned to the high-pitched drone of mosquitoes, foul odors, visible signs of disease, and far more subtle hints that contaminants lurk nearby. When trouble is detected, this defense system spurs us to take immediate evasive steps or, if we do fall ill, it prompts us to react in stereotypical ways to reduce the damage. Scientists are discovering that these protective behaviors, which essentially function like a shadow immune system, can be surprisingly sophisticated. Creatures with no knowledge of the germ theory of disease have an instinct for healing and staying well. Good hygiene, vaccination, therapeutic interventions, these are the pillars of modern medicine. Yet animals of almost every stripe engage in these practices, as did early humans. Indeed, were it not for these evolved defenses, the immune system would quickly be overwhelmed. One of the most familiar but widely misinterpreted examples of this phenomenon is what scientists call sickness behavior. When you're ill, you spike a fever, lose your appetite, and become depressed and listless. Contrary to popular belief, these symptoms don't mean that the disease agent is weakening you, but just the opposite. They demonstrate that the brain, in conjunction with the immune system, is mounting a multi-pronged campaign against the invader. Infectious organisms typically can live only within a narrow temperature range, so fever kills them in droves basically by boiling them, a brilliant defensive tactic, but one that requires a vast amount of energy. To turn up the body's thermostat just 1 degree Celsius requires roughly the same number of calories that an average adult would expend walking 40 kilometers. To funnel that much energy to the battlefield, the brain begins snapping orders. Stop moving about. Stop looking for a mate. Stop foraging for food and spending precious energy digesting it. Stop everything and go to bed. And so you fall into a feverish sleep. Fever is so important for slaying germs that animals that cannot regulate their own body temperature, for example, locusts, baby rabbits, and cold-blooded creatures like lizards, have found alternative means to cook pathogens. They sunbathe. Lest anyone doubt that sickness behavior is a defense against pathogens, scientists can induce it without exposing animals to a single germ. They manage this simply by injecting healthy rodents with immune components called cytokines. The once frisky animals refuse to eat or drink and lose their passion for running in their wheels. Up go their temperatures and down go their heads. They act and feel sick even though they're healthy. Sometimes fever and related defenses are not enough to control rapidly multiplying germs and the slew of poisons they churn out. In such situations, the nervous system may aid the immune system by opening valves at key junctures in the GI tract while simultaneously reversing the rhythmic contractions of the intestine, forcing food back up from whence it came. Meanwhile, the brain begins signaling wave upon wave of nausea. You know what happens next. You throw up. Congratulations. In just a few convulsions, you've ejected an army of nasty germs. Vomiting is not just a means of getting rid of harmful microbes, but also a preventative measure. A phenomenon known as sympathetic vomiting occurs when the sight of someone throwing up causes others to do so too. Such copycat behavior probably evolved to protect us from food poisoning, a hazard that was both more common and more lethal in generations past. Imagine yourself seated beside a primeval fire, enjoying a communal meal of antelope stew, when the person beside you begins retching up his dinner. The stew may not have been to blame for his explosive bout of illness, but under the circumstances, it would be a wise precaution to react the same way, which is why nausea, scientists believe, can be highly contagious. Many scientists have advanced our understanding of behavioral defenses against parasites, but Benjamin L. Hart, a veterinarian and neurobiologist at the University of California at Davis, stands out for the size and scope of his contribution. In the 1970s, Hart connected fever to other sickness behaviors, intuiting the evolutionary advantage of linking the traits. In addition to his own research, his overview articles have created a conceptual framework for the field, stoking scientific interest in the phenomenon. A man with an astute eye and a gift for seeing connections between disparate findings, Hart has not limited his investigations to the laboratory. Many of his insights stem from long sojourns that he and his wife, Lynette, a fellow faculty member in the UC Davis Veterinary School, spent in Africa studying wild animals. When they first saw them up close, both recall being amazed by their robust health. "Being in a veterinary school, you know how much care we give our pets and zoo animals," he said. "We keep them in clean, sheltered environments, disinfect their wounds, vaccinate them, and give them antibiotics and other drugs. Wild animals, in contrast, get scratched and mauled, exposed to swarms of biting insects, and feast on carcasses dragged across dirt. Yet in spite of receiving no medical attention, their parasite levels are typically low. They get along fine in nature without any intervention. Some of them thrive." Before speaking with the Harts, I assumed animals, and the humans of yore, expended far more energy dodging big predators than tiny parasites. I now suspect the opposite is closer to the truth. And that doesn't take into account the cogs always spinning in the background of our minds, sparking inexplicable sexual attractions, a hunger for sleep, weird dietary cravings, and who knows what other peculiar urges, all to keep us safe from parasites. Meanwhile, we are oblivious to the origins of these drives or the minefield of hazards they help us navigate. Just warding off parasites that live on the surface of the body, lice, mites, ticks, mosquitoes, and the like, can be an exhausting, full-time job in itself. These real-life vampires come in endless varieties. Human and birds alone attract over 2,000 species of fleas. The term for these pests is ectoparasites. Ecto means outside, signifying their tendency to live on rather than inside another animal's body. And they are not just a nuisance. Tabanid flies can siphon off a pint of a horse's blood in a day. Just half a dozen engorged ticks on a delicate gazelle or impala can weaken these fast sprinters, turning them into easy marks for predators. Warble flies can reduce the annual weight gain of cattle by 20 to 70 kilograms, about 50 to 150 pounds. Ectoparasites are all around bad news. They sap energy, stunt growth, and diminish animals' success at winning territory and competing for mates. If the infested animals do manage to breed, they produce fewer offspring and less milk to feed them. Ectoparasites also carry microscopic parasites, the germs that cause scourges like malaria, dengue, and Lyme disease, which these insects transmit to their hosts as they feed. Small wonder animals go to extreme lengths to avoid such pests. Rodents spend one-third of their waking lives grooming. Blue herons peck at the mosquitoes hovering beneath them an astonishing 3,000 times an hour. Horses and other hoofed animals shake their heads, twitch their ears, stamp the ground, swish their tails, bunch together, and if all else fails, gallop away. Some animals even make their own fly swatters. While in Nepal, Hart was surprised to see an Asian elephant break off a large branch of a tree, remove excess leaves to fashion it into a switch, and then shake it over its head and body. "It's tool use," said Hart, "and their switch really does cut down on flies." Gazelles and impalas take a different approach to dislodging parasites. They use their teeth as combs, scraping ticks off their coats and orally grooming themselves 2,000 times a day. These heroic efforts are not for naught. Mice prevented from grooming have 60 times more lice. Those herons fiendishly pecking at mosquitoes stop 80% of their would-be attackers from robbing their blood. And in a study the Harts conducted on wild impalas, They showed that grooming behavior reduces an animal's tick load 20-fold. Pest avoidance strategies can be more sophisticated than meets the eye. Gazelles and impalas, the Harts discovered, groom even when they have no ticks. Several times an hour, said Benjamin Hart, a clock in the animal's head tells it to systematically scrape clean the very path that ticks typically travel en route to the head or rear end, where they're out of the animal's reach. The phenomenon, which the couple dubbed programmed grooming, is now well accepted, but they initially had a hard time selling their peers on the idea, he recalled. They'd say, the animal itches. They groom because they itch. I'd say, ticks are very good at not being felt when they bite. Their response, oh, Ben, why are you wasting your time studying that? Finally, after returning from Africa, the couple went to the San Diego Zoo Safari Park and recorded the behavior of Thompson's gazelles, which were tick-free in their sanitary enclosure. Yet they groomed themselves anyway, just like clockwork. The Harts' findings may have initially been greeted with skepticism because scientists for the longest time underestimated the damage ectoparasites could inflict on their hosts. As Lynette Hart explained, they thought grooming felt good and was all about social bonding. Of course, for many gregarious species, it is about bonding too, but it's also nice to have another set of hands, paws, or teeth for removing hard-to-reach parasites. Mice, penguins, deer, and primates, among other species, maintain lower pest levels with the help of a mate or buddy than they would if left to their own devices. In impalas, Lynette reported, reciprocal grooming is done strictly tit-for-tat and is another example of programmed behavior. They do it whether or not either party has ticks. One impala walks straight up to another and delivers a bout of 8 or so grooming strokes to the neck. If its partner does not immediately reciprocate, and virtually the same number of times, the impala will go somewhere else. They don't allow much cheating, said Lynette. Wood mice and long-tailed macaques have adopted a different barter system. These species pay for grooming with sex. Other animals outsource the job to different species. This is an especially common arrangement in the marine ecosystem. Large fish arrive at special territories called cleaning stations and pop open their mouths. In swim little fish and tiny shrimp, which eat up all the parasites and other tidbits clinging to their teeth and gills. Oxpecker birds perform a similar function in Africa for rhinos, buffalo, zebras, giraffes, and eland. One of the bird's specialties, said Benjamin Hart, is cleaning out ears, a favorite hiding spot for ticks. You can see animals making these little postural shifts to allow the birds to get deep in there and dig them out. Wild animals' resilience is all the more remarkable when you consider that the vast majority of parasites are too small to be detected with the unaided eye. Given that nature's creatures don't come into the world equipped with microscopes or medicine cabinets, how are they so successful at warding off infection? One of their many tricks is to avail themselves of what Hart calls the medicine cabinet in their mouth. When injured by a bite, gash, or scrape, numerous species, among them primates, felines, canines, and rodents, use their tongue like an antiseptic wipe to clean wounds. Saliva is rich in antimicrobial agents, immune-boosting substances, fungicides, and growth factors for stimulating health of both skin and nerves. In laboratory experiments, the removal of rodents' salivary glands retarded the healing of their skin wounds. In another study, a sheet of human cells grown in culture was punctured to simulate a wound. The addition of saliva to the petri dish prompted cells in the area of the injury to grow much more quickly than those not so treated. In the right situation, said Hart, the old saying, go lick your wounds, is very good advice. Like primates today, our ancestors probably licked their wounds too, he and Lynette believe. Modern humans may continue the tradition, albeit perhaps unknowingly. A few days after my conversation with the Harts, I accidentally nicked my finger while slicing an orange. Instantly, I began sucking on the cut. Only after my finger had flown into my mouth did I recall their words or think to reach for soap and water. Saliva can prevent germs from entering the body through other routes. After copulating, male rodents, cats, and dogs will furiously lick their penises for several minutes. The liberal application of saliva kills several pathogens that are leading causes of STDs in these species. Their habit also benefits females because it prevents males from passing on infections to their next mates. Interestingly, cattle and horses, which can't lick their own penises, are much more prone to STDs. One of the reasons, according to the Harts, they're bred by artificial insemination. Humans, they add, are also very susceptible to STDs, possibly owing to similar anatomical limitations. Lactating females of many mammalian species have found still another healthful purpose for saliva. They use their tongues to sponge away germs on their nipples before allowing their young to nurse. Rodent pups may even refuse to attach to her tit unless it has first been washed with her saliva, said Hart. Another smart move for staying free of parasites is to avoid those mounds of germs we call feces. Humans recoil at the sight and smell of bodily waste, and it serves us well. Contact with fecal contaminants can expose us to a long list of hazards, including numerous varieties of intestinal worms, cholera, typhoid fever, hepatitis, and rotavirus, a leading killer in the developing world. Poop poses just as broad an array of dangers to other species, many of which react to it much as we do. Chimpanzees have, in Jane Goodall's words, an almost instinctive horror of being soiled with excrement. When they accidentally come in contact with feces, they grab fistfuls of leaves and vigorously wipe it off. Even sex can quickly lose its appeal if excrement enters into the picture. Goodall reported that when a female chimp signaled her eagerness to copulate by raising her rump to a male, he initially seemed game until he spotted a diarrhea smear on her fur, whereupon he opted to abstain. Another male, no doubt with fewer prospects, eventually took her up on her offer, but not before first meticulously wiping off the offending spot with leaves. Other animals are equally fastidious when it comes to feces. Mole rats and other small mammals that live inside burrows build underground latrines that are separated from their living quarters and larders. Lemurs in Madagascar have their own version of an outhouse, mounds above ground, which they visit only to relieve themselves. Cows, sheep, and horses don't graze near fresh dung heaps, no matter how lush the grass is in the vicinity of those piles. Wolves, hyenas, and big cats never soil their own dens. An instinct, said Hart, that accounts for why humans find it so easy to house train their domesticated relatives. That's not true for all dog breeds, however. Shih Tzus and miniature terriers can take years to house train, he cautioned, because that instinct was diluted by their human breeders. Fish, too, have their taboos about where it's not proper to poop. When nature calls, several species are known to swim to the edge of their home range or just beyond. Even the birds and the bees have good potty habits. Northern flicker woodpeckers remove their nestlings' poop, which conveniently comes wrapped in gelatinous sacs, the avian equivalent of a diaper, 50 to 80 times a day. For comparison, a human baby gets roughly that number of diaper changes in a week. As for bees, some are known to make a bathroom run a group event. When they feel the urge to go, they fly away from the hive and relieve themselves all at once, showering a yucky yellow mist over whoever is below. On a visit to Laos in 1985, Alexander M. Haig, Jr., then Secretary of State, mistook clouds of bee poop for chemical warfare. Avoiding the sick is no less important for staying well. Down through the ages, humans have been quick to flee and isolate those they feared could spread much-dreaded diseases like leprosy, bubonic plague, TB, polio, virulent strains of the flu, and later, AIDS and Ebola. Reasoning, albeit highly primitive over most of history, and advancing medical knowledge have motivated these actions. But there may be an innate component to these impulses, too, for we are not alone among animals in shunning those who display signs of disease. Bullfrog tadpoles can sense a chemical signal in the water emanating from a tadpole with a yeast infection of the GI tract, whereupon they swim in the opposite direction. Likewise, rodents can detect the odor of parasite-infested members of their own kind, whom they then avoid or keep at a distance through aggressive displays. Killifish, treated with a dye to imitate the dark splotches caused by a trematode infection, are not as attractive shoal mates as their unmarked counterparts. Apes show similar tendencies. A male chimp who was never short of grooming partners when healthy, Goodall reported, became an outcast after polio cost him the control of his hind limbs and flies began to hover around him. Shunning sources of contagion is an excellent first line of defense, but boosting the body's resistance to infection is equally critical. We think of vaccines as a sophisticated tool of modern medicine, but animals and humans without MDs have also figured out ways to vaccinate. When an ant gets a deadly fungus, for example, another member of its colony will rush up and lick it, thereby exposing the insect to a tiny dose of the disease agent. This method of inoculation is not without perils. 2% of ants perish, but the vast majority develop heightened immunity to the infection, according to the evolutionary biologist Sylvia Kremer, who studies the insects. Interestingly, their approach resembles a technique for vaccinating against smallpox that was used by people in northern Africa long before an 18th-century English physician named Edward Jenner received credit for inventing the world's first vaccine against the disease. In this ancient practice, a scab from someone with smallpox was rubbed into a tiny cut on the skin of a healthy person. And just as in the case of inoculated ants, 2% of those people died. The custom, however, appears to have averted far more tragedies than it caused, lowering the mortality rate from smallpox by 25%. Today's vaccines, it should be noted, contain only non-infectious components of pathogens, and the risk of death from their use is infinitesimal. Mothers of newly weaned carnivores like lions may take a messier approach to vaccination, reported Hart. They drag the cub's first serving of red meat across the den floor, coating it in bacteria and dirt. These contaminants make for a healthy meal because they prime the young animal's immune system to better withstand the barrage of germs they'll soon encounter when they begin hunting themselves. Indeed, clay-like compounds similar to those found in dirt are often intentionally put into medical vaccines today because such adjuvants, as doctors call them, enhance the immune system's response. Some species of monkeys are thought to inoculate their young by passing their newborns from one member of the colony to the next. Exposing them to communal germs so soon after birth may seem like a bad idea, but they must be able to fend for themselves early on, said Hart, so their immune systems need to mature as fast as they do. Primates that develop more slowly, like humans, can afford to insulate newborns from all but the closest of kin until, little by little, their defenses strengthen. As soon as babies start to crawl around, however, they seem programmed to put virtually any object within reach into their mouths, including, inevitably, all sorts of cringeworthy things. The sponge used to clean the sink, a pacifier dragged across the floor, what the cat spit up, rocks and snails from the garden, and, of course, dirt. Babies normally swallow as much as a gram each day. Such oral inclinations have traditionally been explained as exploratory activity. How babies learn about the tastes, textures, and other properties of objects around them. But nature is famous for multitasking, so it may well be that sampling their surroundings is training both their senses and defenses. Maybe their adventurous palates are one more example of animal-style immunization. Complementing that view, proponents of a popular, though still hotly contested theory, the hygiene hypothesis, believe that rearing children in too clean an environment may make them more susceptible to allergies and other diseases. These scientists believe that an immune system that is repeatedly tested early in life becomes sharper at distinguishing between good and bad germs, making it better at gauging when to mount a counterattack. Recall also that microbiome research has begun to link more diverse gut bacteria to better health, and those microbial populations are established early in childhood. So it certainly makes sense that babies have evolved to increase their uptake of germs, once the dangerous period early in infancy has passed. All these ideas need stronger confirmation, but if they are proven to be valid, they have provocative implications. It may be that in our zeal to create safe, sterile environments for our children, we have replaced natural inoculation with manufactured vaccines, antibiotics, and allergy medications. No one would want to return to the era before these advances, when many babies never made it to adulthood. But perhaps a little laxity in our housekeeping and hygiene standards might do more good than harm. Pharmaceutical corporations might even take a lesson from nature. Imagine pills of the future that contain thousands of the bacteria in soil that help stimulate immunity, but none of the nasty germs like Toxoplasma and Toxocara. Basically, a safe-to-consume mud pie. We've focused on behaviors that might have evolved to reduce our susceptibility to pathogens. But there is one very risky activity that's hard to avoid and so must be undertaken with extreme care. That activity is sex. The commingling of bodies during mating offers parasites a wonderful opportunity to jump hosts and sicken more victims. Should those pathogens invade the genital tract, moreover, they can cause sterility. If a female becomes impregnated by an infected partner, her offspring might be born deformed or diseased. Any trace of illness in a prospective mate might signify that he or she has a weak immune system, a deficiency that, if passed down to the next generation, could doom one's lineage. To avoid these steep costs, animals have evolved courtship rituals that typically involve displays of great strength and vigor, and the least hint of illness or weakness in the animal kingdom is invariably a sexual turnoff. Like men who pump iron to impress women with their bulging muscles, male guppies court females by repeatedly flexing their bodies into an S shape. Fish infested with parasites perform fewer of these displays with predictable results. The weaker suitor is the loser. Female mice are just as choosy. When it comes time for coupling, they'll sniff a prospective partner, and if his smell betrays the presence of a pathogenic protozoan in his GI tract, he will be snubbed. As part of their mating ritual, sage grouse puff up yellow air sacs normally hidden under their breast feathers. Should an inflated neck reveal the swollen bite marks of lice, or red spots applied by a scientist to mimic them, a female will look for another partner. In many other bird species, females shun prospective mates with lackluster plumage or ornamentation, another indicator of parasitic infection. In one telling experiment, red jungle fowl were infected with an intestinal nematode. Compared to uninfected males, they had duller eyes and combs, shorter tail feathers, and paler hackle feathers. Underwhelmed by the drabber males, the females were half as likely to mate with them than with healthy males. Humans may also rely on visual cues to find partners with robust immune systems, an indication that they're likely to endow heirs with heightened resistance to germs. Beauty is associated with not just youth and fertility, but also health and previous successes in fighting off pathogens. Good looks, for example, are denoted by symmetrical features, a sign that early life development was not disrupted by infection, and skin that shows no trace of pockmarks, sores, or other blemishes. With that in mind, you'd expect beauty to be more valued by those more susceptible to germs, a theory that evolutionary biologists put to the test in a survey of over 7,100 people on 6 continents. In keeping with their prediction, those who lived in countries where parasites were leading causes of death and disability, in Nigeria and Brazil, for example, deemed good looks much more important in a mate than did inhabitants of nations like Finland and the Netherlands, which have among the lowest incidences of infection. In a British study, merely prompting people to think of germs by, for example, showing them photos of a festering skin sore or a white cloth with a dark stain resembling a fecal smear, boosted how much they preferred symmetrical faces in the opposite sex. Not just our eyes, but also our noses may guide us in choosing partners whose genes will endow our children with heightened protection against infectious disease. That claim, which is still contentious, has gained traction as a result of scientists' deepening understanding of a large cluster of 200 or so genes called the Major Histocompatibility Complex, or MHC. These genes code for cell surface molecules that enable the body to distinguish its own cells from foreign invaders, marking the latter for destruction. Most people are familiar with MHC genes in the context of organ transplantation. The success of such an operation depends on the donor and recipient sharing many of those genes in common. A mismatch could spark an immune attack, leading the organ to be rejected. In the 1990s, experiments on rodents revealed that MHC genes do more than just control a mouse's ability to detect foreign cells. They also determine its characteristic body odor. Put more simply, scent broadcasts vital information about the inner workings of an individual's immune system to other animals. What's more, the rodents preferred to mate with animals whose MHC genes were the least like their own, a choice based on a prospective partner's scent profile. Their progeny, as a result, had more diverse immune genes, and that variability enhanced their survival. When parents have similar immune genes, their offspring tend to be susceptible to the same germs. So if one animal in a litter is killed by an infection, the rest are likely to perish with it, spelling the end of a family lineage. That liability is greatly amplified if, owing to a drastic decline in a group's population size, its members become inbred. Under those circumstances, a single viral infection can decimate the group's members. Inbred populations are also at greater risk of suffering from hereditary disease as a result of individuals inheriting two recessive genes, one from each parent, for a deleterious trait. Incest, an extreme form of inbreeding, carries the same risks, only further elevated. In the case of humans, knowledge of the harmful physical and psychological consequences of incest no doubt contributes to the prevalence of this taboo in most societies. But it's also a rarity in nature. Indeed, incest accounts for fewer than 2% of births in wild animal populations. Scent, scientists began to think, might be nature's way of discouraging unfavorable biological pairings. Inspired by the animal research, a Swiss zoologist, Klaus Wedekind, sought to determine if smell might have an unconscious influence on our species' mate preferences. In a famous experiment conducted on college students at the University of Bern, he gave males clean cotton t-shirts and instructed them to wear them for 2 nights and avoid using deodorant or any other scented products over that period. After collecting the sweaty shirts, he asked women to sniff them and rank their odor according to which they liked best. Dovetailing with animal studies, the women preferred the smell of men whose MHC genes were the most dissimilar from their own. And the male odors they liked the best reminded them of the scent of a current or previous sexual partner. More recently, Wedekind and colleague Manfred Malinsky made another intriguing discovery. People who share certain portions of MHC genes tend to prefer the same perfume scents. Perhaps, they speculate, we unconsciously choose fragrances that enhance our natural body odors, explaining the widespread use of perfumes over human history. Meshing nicely with these results, independent studies of Europeans as well as Americans of European descent, notably the Hutterites and Mormons, suggest MHC opposites are indeed drawn to each other. In a related line of research, investigators theorized that where pathogens are most prevalent, natural selection should favor the survival of people with more diverse MHC genes. After analyzing human genome data collected from 61 populations around the globe, they found exactly that. Also complementing Wedekind's work, research conducted in the laboratory of Rachel S. Herz, an expert on the psychology of smell at Brown University, showed that women rate body odor as the single most alluring, or off-putting, physical trait in a man. If a man's natural odor smells wrong to a woman, Herz's research suggests, she won't want to have sex with him no matter how dazzling his other qualities. Herz did not look at her subjects' MHC genes, but she strongly suspects a woman's preference for some scents over others is likely shaped by whether a man's odor signifies his immune system genes will complement her own. Not all the evidence ties together so neatly, however. Studies of the Yoruba of Nigeria and Amerindians of South America failed to find that mate choice was influenced by a partner's MHC genes. Other research suggests MHC odor preferences do influence whom a partner finds sexually attractive, but in a more complicated fashion than previously assumed. Among other things, it appears that such preferences can be altered by early life experiences. Strong support for this view comes from an experiment in which female mice were separated at birth from their own litters and placed in the litters of other mothers. Upon maturing, the females would not copulate with the unrelated males who nursed beside them on the same mother's nipples, their adopted brothers, if you will. In a reversal of the natural order, they chose to mate with their own genetic brothers. This suggests the sense of those who surround us when we're young leave a lasting imprint on the brain, defining our sense of kin and the kinds of odors we will later find sexually enticing. Nature's rule of thumb might be summed up thus. If he or she smells like someone you grew up with, look elsewhere for a sexual partner. Of course, no comparable experiment has been performed on humans, but circumstantial evidence hints that a similar form of olfactory imprinting may occur in our species. It's long been known that unrelated children who are raised together in a communal environment such as a kibbutz almost never marry each other. Perhaps because their scents, familiar since infancy, falsely mark them as biological siblings. The law has one definition of incest. The brain may have another. Eons ago, hundreds of millions of years before humans showed up on the scene, sex itself may have evolved as a defense against parasites. To understand why, consider the alternative, asexual reproduction, also known as cloning. A strategy favored by single-celled organisms like bacteria, it entails simply splitting in two to create identical copies of the parent. Because clones multiply at a ferocious pace, they rapidly accrue beneficial mutations that allow them to overcome their host's defenses. Multicellular hosts, like ourselves, replicate too slowly to rely on new mutations to protect us. We need a better shield. The invention of sex is evolution's solution to that challenge, according to a popular theory championed in the 1990s by evolutionary biologists Lee Van Vallen and William D. Hamilton. After briefly falling out of favor, the theory now appears to be ascendant again, buoyed by recent studies of animals both in the wild and in laboratory settings. What makes sex such a game changer, its proponents believe, is the simple fact that genes get reshuffled every time they're passed down from parents to their offspring. If you're human, that includes the 200 or so genes that make up the MHC, which can be inherited in billions of different combinations. Thanks to sex, each of us is biologically unique, which means you and your neighbors will vary in your susceptibility to pathogens. When a deadly bug comes to town, you won't all die. Even as Ebola, an unusually vicious virus, raged through West Africa at the end of 2014, roughly 30% of infected people managed to survive its ravages, and this despite receiving minimal or no medical care. Many of these lucky people may have lacked a molecule on the surface of their cells that the virus must latch onto in order to invade them. Precisely because we aren't clones, we wear different targets on our backs. An array of cell surface molecules that serve as docking sites for different pathogens, and the prevalence of these markers within a population can fluctuate dramatically depending on the latest infection going around. No sooner has a pathogen locked onto one target than that docking site, and the people who carry it, diminishes in frequency due to the success of the microbe's own killing spree. The germ's destructive power declines until it mutates into a new virulent strain that can zero in on a different target. In subsequent generations, meanwhile, people sporting the first target may resurge in numbers because the rapidly evolving pathogen is now pursuing other quarry. In this way, Van Vallen and Hamilton postulated, We and other sexual reproducers stay one step ahead of the parasites nipping at our heels. And so we chase each other round and round. This theory is called the Red Queen hypothesis after the character in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, who says to Alice, "It takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place." A major appeal of this hypothesis is that it would explain a profound mystery, namely how a mode of replication as slow and inefficient as sex, which requires considerable exertion, comical contortions, and a willing mate, can persist side by side with cloning. Just think, bacteria can easily churn out more generations of offspring in a day than humans produce in a millennium. Yet sex enables us to compete in the same arena. Sleep is a puzzle that has occupied many great minds, for just like sex, its evolutionary benefits are far from obvious. When deep in slumber, we are highly vulnerable to predators, and the extended blackouts cut down on time spent foraging for food, searching for mates, and caring for children. So why spend so many hours in this dangerous and unproductive manner? A novel theory posits that sleep evolved to shunt resources that would normally sustain waking activities toward the immune system. Recall that people sleep more when fighting an infection to meet the defense system's increased demand for fuel. In times of peace, the army still needs to be fed and the troops replenished. Indeed, immune cells gobble up nutrients at a ferocious pace and have rapid turnover rates. One major type, the granulocyte, is so short-lived that these cells must be replaced every 2 to 3 days. Even when we're healthy, according to this view, a daily period of inactivity is essential for covering the steep energy costs involved in keeping the war machine ready for battle. The immune theory of sleep, as it's been dubbed, aligns with the wisdom of mothers who have long been telling their children to get a good night's rest, intuitively grasping sleep's necessity for staying well. The theory is also gaining support from several lines of research. Sleep deprivation, animal studies show, does indeed increase susceptibility to infection. Also consistent with that observation, insufficient sleep immediately before or after receiving a vaccine reduces the body's immune response by half, greatly diminishing the protective benefits of inoculation, something to keep in mind when you're due for your next flu shot. Perhaps the most persuasive evidence that sleep boosts our resistance to parasites comes from research conducted by an international team of evolutionary biologists led by Charles Nunn and Brian Preston. The group gathered data on the sleep habits of 26 species of mammals with daily hours of slumber ranging from a skimpy 3.8 in sheep to a luxurious 17.6 in hedgehogs. The scientists found that across these species, more sleep strongly correlated with enhanced immune function as measured by the number of immune cells circulating in their blood. What's more, the longer a species typically dozes, the lower its level of parasitic infection. Traditional theories of sleep underscore its importance in consolidating memory and learning, as well as its role in removing waste products from the brain. As there's strong support for these ideas too, it appears that sleep may well rejuvenate both the brain and the immune system. That means skimping on it, as so many of us do, may be inviting double trouble. Animals not only act in stereotypical ways to reduce their risk of infection, the more resourceful among them also exploit compounds in their habitat to that end. Even more impressive, some have a knack for choosing medicinal plants. Intriguingly, reports Benjamin Hart, their criteria are the same as traditional healers. Both groups have a tendency to seek bitter cures for infection. After gathering data on the palatability of 22 herbal remedies, he found that 16 were bitter, and some healers specifically equated the potency of treatments with their bitterness. This belief has a basis in science. Bitterness is a measure of toxicity. So these compounds are often effective in killing germs, intestinal worms, and other parasites. The expression, a bitter pill to swallow, recognizes the unfortunate truth that powerful cures are often foul-tasting. Mary Poppins recommended a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down. The modern pharmaceutical industry has tried to disguise medication's unpleasantness with grape and cherry flavors. Yet since antiquity, humans have endured these awful remedies, but only when sick. Otherwise, we spit them out. Some species of tiger moth caterpillars also reverse their food preferences when ill. Normally, they won't eat the bitter plant Plantago insularis, but when parasitized by insects, they suddenly develop a craving for it. As it turns out, the poisons in the plant's leaves are toxic to the parasites. Wild chimps show exactly the same tendency. When suffering from diarrhea and other patent signs of infection, reported primatologist Michael A. Huffman, they'll take long detours from their normal route in search of Vernonia, a toxic, astringent-tasting plant with compounds thought to inhibit the growth of amoebas, bacterial pathogens, and intestinal worms. Upon finding it, an ill animal will meticulously peel away the bark of a fresh shoot, exposing its pith, and suck on its very bitter juices. Healthy bystanders in its troop may watch as it slurps up the juices, but don't themselves partake. The young and curious, however, sometimes need discouragement, Huffman observed. On seeing a sick adult toss away the remnant of a Vernonia pith, a baby chimp attempted to pick it up, evidently with the intent of tasting it. His mother stepped on the pith and carted him away. Goodall recorded a similar tale. With the hope of coaxing ill chimps to take a bitter antibiotic, she tucked the remedy into bananas. The sick animals readily ate the fruits, medicine and all, but healthy members of the colony would eat only unadulterated bananas. Herbivores are known to consume a wide variety of leaves, berries, fruits, and other plant components with medicinal properties. Not all of them are bitter and toxic, or if they are, only mildly so. And consequently, they may be a part of an animal's everyday diet. Afrimomum, a plant in the wild ginger family with a pungent, spicy flavor, is a case in point. It makes up a large proportion of the foods consumed by Western lowland gorillas, who eat its pith and seed pods. Phytochemist John Berry has shown that these parts of the plant are very high in antimicrobial compounds that act in a manner akin to narrow-spectrum antibiotics. That is, they don't kill bacteria indiscriminately, but rather thwart pathogenic strains such as Salmonella and Shigella, while encouraging the growth of healthy gut bacteria. People in some villages in West Africa also eat Afrimomum. It's customary to serve the seed pods, called grains of paradise, when guests come to visit, much as North Americans might set out a bowl of peanuts as a snack. In addition, the plant is viewed as a medicine. In Uganda, people take Afrimomum for infections caused by bacteria, fungi, and intestinal worms. The distinction between food and medicine can be blurry. That's particularly true of a culinary tradition most of us take for granted, adding a dash of this or that spice to our dishes. Many of these seasonings double as antimicrobial agents, according to research by Cornell evolutionary ecologist Paul Sherman and his former graduate student Jennifer Billing. Before the invention of refrigeration, that benefit would have been of immense value, likely the reason, they believe, that monarchs sent legions of men to fight wars, cross oceans, and explore new lands in order to procure spices. Of 30 species for which the scientists were able to collect data, all killed at least a quarter of bacteria species. Half of the species inhibited the growth of 75% of bacteria. Some of the most widely used, garlic, onion, allspice, and oregano, killed every species they were tested against. Oddly, they found that pepper had only weak antimicrobial effects. How to explain its immense popularity? Their research revealed that it acts synergistically with other spices, dramatically amplifying their bacteria-killing power. An example is quatre épices, pepper, cloves, ginger, and nutmeg. These spices are used together so often in France, especially for the preparation of sausages, that the mixture goes by its own name. Sausages are an excellent growth substrate for Clostridium botulinum, the cause of deadly botulism, so seasoning them with any old spices might be ill-advised. Other famous mixes such as curry powder, made from 22 spices, and chili powder, made from 10, similarly turn out to be, in the words of the scientists, broad-spectrum antimicrobial melanges. Since food, especially meat, spoils more quickly in hot climates, Sherman and Billing predicted that the highest use of spices in the past would be in tropical regions, an idea they tested by combing through the ingredients of thousands of meat-based recipes from centuries-old cookbooks. True to their expectations, in warmer countries, notably Thailand, India, Greece, and Nigeria, all traditional dishes with meat used at least one spice, and some 12 or more. Our ancestors from colder climates, in contrast, had much blander diets. For example, one-third of traditional meat-based recipes from Scandinavia called for no spices at all. A subsequent study of traditional recipes containing only vegetables, a less inviting growth medium for bacteria, found that they had fewer spices than those with meat, providing further support for their hypothesis. Why anyone thought to use spices in the first place is more challenging to explain. After all, they have little or no nutritional value and are not very appetizing on their own. Since even animals are drawn to bitter substances when ill, one likely scenario is that spices were first consumed as medicines. Indeed, garlic, turmeric, ginger, and cumin, to mention just a few, figure prominently in ancient folk cures. In small doses, mixed with meals, spices become more palatable. In other words, consuming them with food, think of Mary Poppins' spoonful of sugar, improved patient compliance. Whatever originally prompted early humans to ingest spices, numerous factors would have favored their incorporation into everyday diets. As Sherman and Billing pointed out, the custom not only cut down on foodborne illness, but also allowed people to preserve food longer, a huge advantage in times of scarcity. In addition, dishes with spices in them may have tasted better, at least to some palates, promoting their broader acceptance. Families who used spices may have touted their many benefits to their neighbors. Another mode of cultural transmission would have occurred in the womb. In the last trimester of pregnancy, we now know, babies sample their mother's diets by ingesting amniotic fluid. After birth, they show a preference for flavors that they encountered prenatally, biasing them toward eating foods and spices that are healthful in their communities. A passion for spices may even have been genetically transmitted, suggested Sherman and Billing. Early on, spice lovers, especially in hot climates, would presumably have left more heirs than those who couldn't stomach them. Darwinian gastronomy, they pithily remarked in an article in Scientific American, may explain why some like it hot. Adding spices to meals may be an early example of preventative medicine, but a few other culinary practices for cutting down the risk of food poisoning are at least as old, if not far more ancient. Familiar to most of us, these include the salting, smoking, and most important, roasting of meat. Indeed, the harnessing of fire for cooking, first clearly documented at campsites occupied by Neanderthals 500,000 years ago, remains the single most widely used weapon for zapping germs that lurk in meals. Animals that lack our ability to preserve and cook food must, of course, adopt other behaviors to prevent foodborne infections. For dogs and cats, one such behavior is eating grass. As Benjamin Hart explains, they do so to flush intestinal worms out of their systems. The animals usually can't know if they have intestinal worms, so they occasionally eat grass as a form of prophylaxis. Puppies and kittens do this most often because their small size makes them particularly vulnerable to the energy-draining effects of parasites. Our pets inherited this behavior from their wild ancestors. Wolves and cougars, for example, regularly eat grass, which is found in about 2-4% of their scat, sometimes along with worms they've expelled. The consumption of leaves, according to primatologist Huffman, may serve the same function in chips, bonobos, and lowland gorillas. The leaves they choose always are covered in ingestible hairs, and the animals never chew them, as they would food, but rather swallow the leaves whole. sometimes as many as 100 at a time. All that roughage, Huffman believes, dramatically accelerates the movement of food through the GI tract, purging them of at least 2 species of parasitic worms. Animals can't call exterminators when their homes become infested with pests, but fortunately some have found methods of handling such problems. Ones, in fact, that are not all that different from our own. Some birds and rodents, especially species that reuse the same nests generation after generation, drive unwanted guests away with toxic vapors, or so think many biologists, who term the strategy fumigation. During breeding season, such creatures can often be seen sprucing up the interiors of their homes with fresh leaves that they weave into old bedding or the thatching of last season's nest. They don't just grab any green twigs that happen to be nearby, said Hart. They hunt for leaves that are strongly aromatic and rich in volatile chemicals. These are markers that they'll be good insecticides, fungicides, and antimicrobials. One plant favored by birds for this purpose is fleabane, so named by ancient herbalists in recognition of its flea-repellent properties. The dusky-footed wood rat prefers California bay laurel, whose leaves they nibble on to release their poisonous fumes. Entomologists use bay laurel in insect-killing jars. They also report that the specimens are more resistant to mold when subsequently pinned to display boards, a clue that rodents may use bay leaves as a fungicide as well. In field experiments involving birds, removal of fresh green twigs from spruced-up homes had predictable results. One starling nest, for example, became overrun with mites. Nature's pharmacopoeia contains a bounty of insecticidal and antimicrobial substances that animals harness for their healthful properties. Wild Kodiak and brown bears dig up OSHA roots, Ligusticum wallichii, and L. porteri, chew on them to release their volatile oils, and then work the paste deep into their pelts. Hinting at the root's medicinal value, the Navajo people use it as an antibacterial and anesthetic salve, and according to their legend, the burly beasts taught them about its healing power. In Panama, white-nosed coati, cousins of the raccoon, travel long distances to obtain the menthol-smelling resin of Tratinikia aspera trees, which they vigorously smear over their bodies with their paws. Compounds in the resin, chemical tests show, repel fleas, lice, ticks, and mosquitoes. Not all the drugs animals reach for are botanicals. Wedge-capped capuchin monkeys in Venezuela roll their bodies over millipedes to stimulate the insects to release defensive toxins and then frenetically apply the chemicals to their fur with a liberal quantity of their own drool. The millipedes evolved the toxins to repel their insect enemies, so the monkeys are, in effect, stealing their bug spray. Birds, some 200 species of them, use a similar strategy. They crush ants with their beaks, causing them to release their own version of insect repellent, then rub the bugs through their feathers. Right underneath our feet is another much-prized natural medicine. It shields the gut from a long list of food and waterborne pathogens, properties that are sought after by droves of animals and hundreds of thousands of people around the world. This potent elixir is dirt. Both humans and animals are very picky about what dirt they'll eat. They'll turn their noses up at the dark, coarse topsoil that babies ingest when exploring their surroundings. The earth craved for its medicinal value is typically collected from 10 to 30 inches beneath the ground. Often light in color, it has a high content of clay that is chemically similar or identical to kaolin, the active ingredient in the original formula of kaopectate, the world's best-selling treatment for diarrhea and nausea. Owing to the molecular structure of such clays, they clasp hold of viruses, bacteria, and fungi, all of which then get flushed out in our waste. These compounds similarly bind to poisons produced by pathogens as well as toxic chemicals found in plants that are dietary staples. To add to the benefits of medicinal clays, their fine, slippery texture coats the mucosal lining of the gut, reinforcing the body's natural barrier against parasitic invaders, including amoebas, roundworms, and flatworms. Extensive field observations of five wild chimps at Mahala Mountains National Park in Tanzania show that the animals will grab a handful of clay from termite mounds when suffering from diarrhea and other gastric ailments. According to Cindy Engel, a biologist and author of the book Wild Health, herbivores like gorillas, elephants, rhinos, and parrots obtain the clay from a variety of sources, such as eroding riverbanks, powdery volcanic rocks, and large patches on the ground that they've denuded of vegetation. The clay allows them to exact nutrients from plants that would otherwise be too toxic. But Engel believes these animals also benefit from its power to purge parasites from their systems. Clay is especially valuable to rats, she reported, as those animals can't vomit. When poisoned with lithium chloride by experimenters, they immediately eat clay if given the chance, and are presumed to do the same when their gastric upset is caused by pathogens. People have been consuming clay since at least as far back as ancient Greece and Rome. The practice, called geophagy, continues to this day in traditional societies on every inhabitable continent. Australian Aborigines get their medicinal dirt from termite mounds. In sub-Saharan Africa, earth from clay pits is baked in the sun, air-dried or heated, and then sold in markets for digestive ailments and morning sickness. Slaves brought the custom to the rural American South, where it had already been embraced by Native Americans, and later was adopted by poor whites disparagingly called sandlappers, sandhillers, and hillbillies. Though the practice in recent years has been condemned as disgusting and deviant, geophagy is hardly moribund in the United States. Many geophagists report that they simply can't resist the richness of earth, its delectable aroma, and the way it melts like chocolate on the tongue. When I'm pregnant, one American aficionada of dirt told Time magazine, it's just like taking dope. Highlighting clay's importance in combating infection, a global survey shows that geophagy is most popular in the parasitic hot zone of the tropics, steeply tapers off in temperate climates less conducive to their growth, and is a rarity toward the poles. By far the largest consumers are pregnant women, according to Cornell geophagy expert Sarah L. Young, author of the book Craving Earth, and leader of the team that conducted the survey. This makes sense, in her view, for pathogens and dietary toxins pose the greatest threat when cells in the body are rapidly dividing, as happens during fetal development. During the first trimester of pregnancy, moreover, it's not just the fetus that's at high risk of being harmed by these agents, but also the mother, whose immune system is suppressed to prevent her from rejecting the fetus growing inside her. Not surprisingly, women in India and Africa often report that they first realize they're pregnant when they develop an insatiable lust for dirt, and many swear by it as a treatment for morning sickness. School-age children are the next largest population of clay consumers, probably because rapid cell division during growth spurts makes them more vulnerable to pathogens and toxins. If this accolade to dirt has you hankering to try some, you can purchase it online, as I did, from a favorite supplier of geophagists, Grandma's Georgia White Dirt, www.whitedirt.com. It will be discreetly delivered to your home in an unmarked package. No doubt as a legal hedge, the company markets it as a novelty item, not for human consumption. After opening the parcel, I found what looked like small rocks dusted with a fine white powder. With a little trepidation, I bit into one. It was like chewing on chalk, only oilier in texture. Georgia White Dirt is definitely not my idea of a mouth-watering treat. After one or two swallows, I spat it out and rinsed my mouth with water. Not once, but several times, for I could not seem to get rid of its filmy residue on my tongue. Even after I used a toothbrush to scrub it clean, the oily residue lingered, explaining how it coats the GI tract so effectively, creating a long-lasting barrier to parasites. Perhaps I would have found Georgia White Dirt more palatable if I'd had a bellyache, or if my mother had consumed it while pregnant with me. I suspect a love of clay, like a fondness for spices, may be cultivated in the womb. Pregnant women who share my disdain for dirt may be comforted to hear that morning sickness may itself be a defense against parasites. So, if unavoidable, it need not be a cause for concern. During the first trimester, more than 60% of women suffer from it. And the number one food that causes nausea and revulsion is the dietary item most likely to be contaminated with pathogens, namely meat, including fish and poultry. Pregnant women's famous aversion to hot cuisines is also thought to be adaptive. For the very property that makes spices inhospitable to pathogenic microbes, their toxicity, could harm the fetus. Morning sickness, in other words, may be nature's way of discouraging an expectant mother from consuming foods that might endanger both herself and her developing baby. In keeping with that theory, such aversions are associated with a lower incidence of stillbirths. Throughout this chapter, I've demonstrated that humans are not unusual in having a native talent for healing and staying well. However, please note, we are most definitely unique in having the most advanced behavioral defense system of any creature on Earth. Indeed, our capacity for detecting and dodging parasites without any help from modern medicine is truly stunning. The next chapter will focus on this ability, or feeling to be more exact. It protects us from both tiny parasites and, more surprisingly, human-sized ones. Parasites on society, if you will.